Welcome to It's Who You Know, the podcast, bridging the gap between Jewish leaders and those who follow them. Gain insight from Jewish professionals who make the decisions that influence your Jewish world.
Welcome to It's Who You Know, the podcast. This is your host, Michelle W. Malkin. And our guest today is Jamie Allen Black, who is the executive director for the Jewish Women's Foundation of New York. I asked Jamie on the program today because I had wanted to do a whole series on philanthropy when I returned from the Jewish Funders Network conference last March. When I went to relaunch the program, there were just so many interesting things going on to talk about. I didn't want to limit my focus too much. So Jamie, you're the one who survived. Congratulations. I'm so excited to talk with you. And mostly because I heard about a shift the organization made and was interested in that fact. And clearly, you know, you've had a very long career in this kind of work. So that's enough for me. Jamie, welcome to the program.
Thank you. And thank you for having me. Either we should talk about that my new title is CEO, and or you should change that at the beginning.
Ooh. No, let's talk about it. I'm in.
Okay.
Yeah. So welcome, and let's, you know, start with that.
Okay. So I noticed I'm in a leadership program, the CEO onboarding leadership program, and I noticed that so many of the men had CEO titles and that the women had executive director titles. And then I just did a bit of reading and I found out that that's true across our sector, that more women have executive director titles, more people who head organizations have executive director titles, and more men have CEO titles, even when the jobs are somewhat similar. And I started here thinking about how when a new big job comes up for a CEO of some organization, I hear a lot, well, there are no women who are CEOs. And so I started thinking, okay, you can't be a CEO if you haven't been a CEO. So we need to change our titles because there are plenty of women out there who are doing executive director work, which is actually chief executive officer work, but they don't have the titles. And so they're overlooked when it's time to find someone who's an actual CEO or who's going to be a CEO of an organization. And so I just started a mini movement among people I know, and now I get calls from people I don't know, to talk about why we should be called chief executive officers, what that means to us, not only in terms of a status, but in terms of what kind of work we do. You know, in the external world, meaning outside of the Jewish community, often people don't even know what an executive director is. And they think things like executive assistant or chief of staff or something like that. And so not that we need to be aligned with the corporate world, but we need to be aligned with the world. And in the world, you can't be a CEO unless you've been a CEO. And so I encourage women who are interested in this to talk to their boards, talk to their board chairs, their executive committees, and really examine this. There's lots of articles that have been written about this now, and it's a thing, and it should be done. So it was done for me.
That's awesome, Jamie. So even off the bat, we're not even starting up slow. We're just right on the on-ramp, on our way. I love it. So that's fantastic. And we'll get a little more into that in terms of sort of Jewish communal trends. And it's so awesome that, you know, even just in the intro, there's something that, you know, we've already got to wrestle with here. So let's back up a little bit. Tell us about yourself, how you got into this, how you came to care so much, whether we're called executive directors or CEOs in our Jewish organization. How you got into this role. Love to hear about it.
I got into this role. Well, I'll tell you exactly how I got it. I was pitching a project to the Jewish Women's Foundation of New York to create solo Jewish mom concierges in communities across the country. We were creating at Big Tent Judaism, we created Big Tent communities, which involved having a concierge that people who were not involved in the Jewish community could go to find out what was available. And in San Francisco, we had a grant to put a solo Jewish mom, meaning a mom who doesn't have a partner, in this role where she would be helping single parent families find their way into Judaism, because the research that the San Francisco Jewish Women's Fund did showed that these women were completely isolated, even more isolated than women who didn't have children. These women were almost you know, not intentionally kept out, but not intentionally included either. So I pitched that opportunity to the Jewish Women's Foundation of New York, and I came with two of my colleagues from Big Tent Judaism. We sat for about, I don't know, it was a 20-minute interview. And as I left, a woman who was there, whom I had met one time, turned out she was the wife of one of the board members who were formerly at Big Tent Judaism. And I'd met her one time, and she took me into the coat closet and said, "Did you know our executive director is leaving?" And I said, "No, I had no idea." And she said, "I think you should throw your hat in the ring." So the opportunity for me to get back to working with women and working on causes that were important to me was the impetus for me to really push hard to make this happen, this position happen for me. But I've always been interested in working with women and girls. When I was in high school, I was a leader in BBYO and BBG at the time, the Neighborhood Girls, and I didn't take a career track. I didn't even know there was such a thing anyway in Jewish studies. I was in BBG because I liked the boys and I wanted to like hang out with boys. But I also learned about lots of Jewish stuff that I didn't know anything about and a lot of community service work. So, but I was going to be a Broadway star. So that was like not where I was going at all. Right. I was not doing that. So I came to New York, I went to acting school, I started acting, I got involved with this group of women, and we started our nonprofit organization, A More Perfect Union, to help the women, as you described in the beginning. And basically our theory was that the quality of a woman's relationship directly affects the quality of her life. And that wasn't just about romantic relationships. It meant like the relationship with your dry cleaner, and your relationship with your door person and your kid's bus driver and all of the interactions that women have during their daily life, the quality of them would affect the quality of their lives. And in that also is how do we get support as women? And when we would create, when we created this program for these the women who were in these facilities, what we realized was that they had each other and they weren't using each other for support. They were actually more competitive. And the reason we were brought in the first place is because there was a lot of sexual acting out, and there's a lot of tension in the women's program. And what we tried to do was help them see how women supporting other women was so powerful and how all of these women supporting each other could really make a difference in their lives. So that's what we did. We were really nervy, we were really young, and we knew nothing. So we taught ourselves things like strategic planning and fundraising and board development.
Yeah, that's the best thing to say something new, right?
Right. We know nothing. So we just like learned all this stuff and taught each other. And we did that all told for about 25 years. But about in 1994, I had a son. I still have him. And a few years after he was born, at first I could still do acting stuff. I'd bring him to the theater. It would be really fun. He loved it. And then around school age, so like kindergarten, first grade, we just started to notice that he was in need of more structure. And so my being at the theater, my taking him to the theater at night, my doing anything that was outside of the traditional, 9-to-5 world just was not working for him. So I was approached by someone in my building where I live who said, "There's this job opening and it's really great. It's a great job. It's for this organization called Hadassah. Do you know it?" I was like, no. I mean, I kind of heard of Hadassah, but I had no idea what it was. I didn't even know it was a women's organization. And I, so the job was to, I was supposed to go to the office once a month and then sit in a meeting, and a court reporter would take down all the words of the meeting. And then I would take that court reporter's disc And based on my listening in the meeting and what was said on and typed into the disk, I would create minutes. My job was called minutes editor. And I did that.
That's impressive. That's an old school job. It's awesome.
Right? Like that was a job.
Right.
And
right.
And it was great. And I learned so much because I got to sit in not only on the board meetings, but on the executive committee meetings and on the national board meetings, right. which was like these huge events. And I learned a ton, which of course I took right back to A More Perfect Union and we worked together. Also during that time, I wrote a volunteer manual. I helped the executive committee have board executive committee retreats to learn governance and stuff like that. And it was great. I was using all of my pieces, but I was really bored. And I went to the executive director and I said, I'm really bored. What should I do? And she said, actually, I didn't say, what should I do? I said, if I don't find something else to do here, then I'm going to leave in, right. you know, 3 months.
That's a very self-aware of you to know to say.
Yeah, it was pretty obvious that this was this was not the most stimulating job, except for all the extra stuff I got to do. I loved all the extra
right.
things, but the
See,
actual
I didn't
job itself.
I'm more right. talking about things, but that's awesome. So how'd that go?
So it was great. She said to me, okay, I have three positions. This was Morley Levin, who was executive director at the time. And she said, I have three positions. One is a project manager. One is an office coordinator or something. And one is in development, and it's the director of special projects. Maybe it wasn't even the director. It might even been like a coordinator or something. Right. It was a position to help in development with a project, which was the Israeli-American business community. We were doing a panel for our convention, and that was my job, was to do this thing. And so I said, well, what do you think I should do? And she said, well, I think all three jobs are great, but I think if you want a career, you should move to development.
Right.
So I was like, I didn't know if I wanted a career or not, but that sounded like, you know, a gauntlet was thrown down. And if I really wanted something, I should go for it.
Right.
So I did. And when I was there, it turned out that my job of doing this one panel was one piece of it. But I started to think about, like, why does a development division not have a strategic plan of its own? The organization was having trouble creating one, but we were charged with raising a gazillion dollars,
right.
and we didn't have a plan. So as is the case at Hadassah, every professional is paired with a volunteer. And so I was paired with a woman who happened to be really good at strategic planning. And as I mentioned before, I had taught myself strategic planning for A More Perfect Union. And so I said, well, why don't we do it? And that was the beginning of my kind of trajectory at Hadassah. And it was really the first step into a career, because before that, I had really been acting and doing odd jobs and, you know, whatever. And this was really like, I actually went to work every day.
At your career home, right?
Right. So I did that for a while. And then when the Bernie Madoff situation happened, at first we thought that we lost a lot of money. And so I was tasked with helping to raise, I think it was like $10 million in 100 days or something like that.
Oh my gosh.
And we did, and it was really great. Fast forward a year, what we realized was we actually made money, and we were being clawed back, which meant that the trustee was taking money from people who had earned money and had benefited from Madoff, and was giving it to the people who didn't benefit from Madoff, who had lost money.
Yeah.
So we owed, I think we had made $90 million, and they made a deal of 50 cents on the dollar that we would have to pay back. So it's $45 million. And long story short, they had already laid off a bunch of people because they thought, you know, they'd lost a lot of money and there was a problem. So, I think we lasted like two more years, and then they laid off the development, all the people in development. And because we were liabilities. And basically meaning, right, we had sick time, we had vacation time, we had severance, And the banks basically said, you can't, we're not giving you the loan to do this thing if you have all these liabilities. And so
what a crazy experience to have gone through.
It was crazy. And it was crazy and it was confusing and it was upsetting, but it allowed me for almost a year to stay home and just do some voiceover work, which was my kind of like thing that I kept after I stopped acting. I kept doing voiceovers because I have a studio in my home and I could easily do that. So I just did that for about 10 months. And then I realized that while I was having fun and I was making a couple bucks, I didn't have health insurance once my Hadassah health insurance ran out and I needed to do something. And so I just sent out a couple of resumes, literally. I got a couple of interviews and then Big Tent Judaism, which at the time was called the Jewish Outreach Institute, they hired me. And they hired me as the director of development. And I would travel with the executive director. And what I realized was that if I traveled with him and we were at a gathering and somebody said, what do you do? And I say, oh, I'm the director of development.
Their
eyes glazed over. They had like no interest in talking to me anymore. And so when we went back to New York after that trip to Savannah, Georgia, I said, we need to think about this strategically, like how I'm perceived if I'm going to be out with you. We need to have a different perception, which I guess might have been like my first inkling talking about titles and how titles are perceived in the world. So they changed my job and my title to Director of Strategic Initiatives. And I basically was in charge of the communities, like helping communities to develop resources, time, people, and money in order to create these open, engaging communities for people on the periphery of Jewish life. Okay, so full circle, I'm at Big Tent Judaism. We're doing this great. We rebranded to Big Tent Judaism because we felt it was more evocative of what we did, was create these big tent communities. And then I pitched the position to the Jewish Women's Foundation, and then they hired me. The end. And here I am.
That's awesome. That's awesome. And so how long have you been now at the Jewish Women's Foundation?
I have been here 3.5 years.
Awesome.
And it's been great.
Yeah.
I love it.
So go ahead and tell us a little bit about the foundation, but also, you know, some of your expectations when you took the role, how that, you know, has changed, and then, you know, anything sort of relevant in terms of the work that the foundation does and your involvement with it.
When I first walked in the door, I was given a mandate by the board, and there were three pieces to it. I knew very little about the foundation. All I knew was it supported women and I wanted to do it. Like, that was pretty much it. So what I learned was that we were an organization that supported programs financially, originally that served Jewish women and girls, but eventually that could also serve not just Jewish women and girls, like from the broader community, but the priority was still Jewish women and girls. And we had given away $750,000 the year before I got here. And when I looked at the finances, what I realized was we're a communal foundation, and so we raise the money we give away. I realized that what we were doing was taking money out of our investment account to support these great programs. Now, the investment account was created by women who had given the foundation money to support these great projects. So there's nothing wrong with doing that, except that if we did that for X number of years without raising more money, we'd be out of business. So we either had to raise more money or spend less money. And what we ended up doing for just year one, which is the year that we're in right now, is doing both, right? Raising more, spending less to try to even out the field.
Did they bring you in with sort of this idea that there was probably a problem that they needed help fixing? Or are they just, time to replace an ED, let's replace her, you know, them. And, you know, you just happen to come with the insight that you come with.
Right. So I think that the reason they hired me was because of my fundraising background, right, and my development work. And I knew that. I did know that. So I knew that the goal was to raise money. I just didn't realize the why of it. Like, why was it so important right now to look at that? So, okay, so that's where I was when I walked in the door. The two other mandates, one was to raise the visibility of the foundation, which is what would result in us raising more money, right? More people know about us, more people give us money, right? And then the third was analyzing the impact of our work, of the grants, of our investment in them, everything. So the first thing I did was, of course, look at the budget and figure out what the problem was. And the problem was we were spending way more than we were bringing in. We had one fundraiser a year, that was our luncheon, and it was great. It raised all of our operating costs. And women who participate with the foundation make a donation. And so if you make a donation for, at the time, $2,500 a year, you get to give away up to $500,000 a year. So your dollar was amplified 200 times.
Right.
Like, how great was that as a selling point?
Right.
Really great, right? I want to write a small check and then make a huge impact. Who wouldn't? So, and small being relative, of course.
Right. For $20,000, yeah.
Right. But we weren't balancing our budget on the backs of these volunteers, because the donors, they were called members, donors, supporters. We were using the investment account to subsidize the money we were raising for grants. And so we would raise, I don't even know, $150,000 from the committees that gave away the grants. People participated and they paid a participation fee. And then we were giving away $500,000 at that point. And I thought, that's, do the math. It doesn't work. So that was the financial part. The visibility part kind of came naturally, because the first thing I realized, actually the very first address I gave to the board a week after I was hired, I gave to at the our annual meeting, and I had prepared remarks, but I looked out into the audience, and what I saw looking at me was a room full of white women. And I said, stopped my remarks, and I said, this room does not look like the Jewish community.
Right.
So one of the first things we need to do is figure out how to make this foundation, the Jewish Women's Foundation of New York, look like the Jewish women of New York. And we need to do whatever work that is to make that happen. So that was, I guess, my first initiative, was that we literally did not look like, we didn't have any women of color, not one single woman of color in our midst. And I thought, that just can't be right. So we started an initiative. The very first public event that we did was a women of color in the Jewish community event with three amazing women who talked about what it felt like to be part of the Jewish community as a woman of color. Actually, it was four. It was led by Yavila McCoy, who moderated, Tamara Fish, Natasha Brown, and Shoshana Akua. They were the four women who talked about what it felt like and how their liberation was tied up with our liberation, meaning that until all of us are free, none of us are free. It was really moving. But more importantly, we had about 250 people in the room or watching it live stream. And I think 20 of the women in the audience were women of color. And at one point, Yavila asked them to stand up so that people could see them, because people in the foundation, many of them, and many people in the audience, there were other people in the audience, obviously, had never seen a person of color who was a Jewish person, or they didn't know that they had seen them. So there's a lot that we could talk about the racism in the Jewish community, intentional or unintentional, but that we need to work on.
Right.
Like, right. You know, we that could be a whole other podcast. So But that initiative kind of put us on the map in terms of visibility. That's what we're talking about, was visibility. That was a mandate, was that they wanted us to be visible. And then the Me Too movement happened. And we had been doing events quarterly about emergent issues related to women and girls. We did an event on women who, without children in the Jewish community. It was really interesting, and it's also an interesting topic. We did marginalized women. Like, we have like a whole list of events that we were doing to highlight issues.
So your work really isn't just collecting and distributing money. It seems like there's a very robust community that has been created through this collecting and giving away money that is kind of highlighted around, is it awareness events? So, or how else would you describe kind of the way that you get your community together?
We talk about them as advocacy events. They had an advocacy committee when I first got here that they would bring really incredible women to speak, and maybe 10 people would be in the room. It was just the committee. And I thought, what a missed opportunity this is. They were great events, but they were very small. So we would do these events, and at first, you know, 20 people would come, 30 people would come, and that was great because we didn't know some of these people and they were interested in the topics. And we started to just be out there in the community, right? As a kind of the theory that our role was to educate women about issues that affect women and girls, and educate philanthropists. And anyone can be a philanthropist, whether they have a penny or a million trillion pennies to give away, to think intentionally about their giving and think intentionally about their giving around women and girls. So it was a theory with an entire program attached to it. It's not that we weren't a programming organization before that. I think we'd always done programs. This was a bit more intentional to do more outreach, to find women who were not necessarily attached to anyone in the organization, to bring more diverse women in, including diversity in race and ethnicity, but also age and socioeconomic diversity, to be truly the Jewish Women's Foundation of New York, right?
And that outreach that you did, I mean, because outreach is always, you know, one of those big words, you know, everyone's doing it and no one quite knows how to. So when you're talking about, you know, you're looking to I wouldn't say unaffiliated because that's not quite the context we're talking about, but, you know, to people who don't previously know your organization, what did you do? How did you identify Jewish women in New York City? I don't assume that anyone's sitting on a corner being like, are you Jewish? Are you Jewish? You know, other than kind of just thinking about topics that were interesting and in doing your best to kind of blitz advertise for it and see who comes to you. I mean, I'm just like curious about the strategy in terms of how you even approached that.
The strategy was simple. The more people who knew about us, that's the goal, was the more people who knew about us, the more people would want to be involved with us because we were doing really great stuff.
Right.
We were giving away small grants, but to a lot of organizations, and people would want to be with us because we were great women. And how I got people to come to the events, how we got people to come to the events, was we had a robust outreach. We outreached to people who had been part of the foundation previously but weren't engaged. So we ramped up our US mail and our social media and our email campaigns, and we invited people to share the information with other people. So a woman who maybe was no longer involved in the foundation for whatever reason her interest might be piqued by having, you know, there's something about Me Too in the Jewish communal world, right? And they know that we're doing this thing. And so they come and they bring people with them. So we were using whom we already knew, but we were expanding it, asking them to invite other people. A pretty simple strategy.
And is that was professional led, or was there volunteers that helped with those efforts?
It's a mix.
Yeah.
We have a very strong board and strong committees, and they empower the professionals to do what we know how to do.
Right.
So we ask them.
It worked, you're telling me, right?
Right. Yeah.
We now
exactly.
have a database of 500,000 people.
Right. So what we realized was that if we only asked our members to reach out to people, it would continue to be the same people, right? We have a luncheon. The same members would buy tables generously. Right. They would invite the same 9 other people. And we started to see that we were just like insular. So we wanted to be bigger and we wanted to be bolder and we wanted to be broader and we wanted to raise more money and be more visible. We needed to do things differently and we needed to find avenues where there were other people. One of the things that we did was we stopped having people come into our community only and we went outside. We sit in the Federation building, even though we're not part of the UJA New York. Right. We have our office space is here. That means if we do an event here, people have to come through our doors. They have to come through the Federation doors. Mm. They have to come through the Federation, what's that thing? The scanner.
Yeah.
The security, right? So I didn't know this. Like, to me, it's like, yeah, you just walk in a building, any building in New York, you have to do that. You have to show your ID, you have to walk through it, right? But for people who are not part of our world, that's not necessarily something they're comfortable with.
Right.
Coming into this building, having to go through security. And we realized that. And we realized that one of the reasons we weren't getting the diversity of women we needed and wanted was because there was this barrier. Mm-hmm. And at Big Tent Judaism, we talked about that. What are the barriers to participation?
Right.
One was expecting people to cross your threshold, get out into the community and go to other people's thresholds and cross their thresholds. So we created a part.
Are emotional and mental, and in this case, physical. Thinking about that whole.
Oh, my goodness.
The user experience.
So many.
Thinking, right?
Yeah. And territorial.
Yeah.
Right, the Jewish community is very territorial,
especially where you're operating in Manhattan, there are lots of
problems. Right. Right. But the Harlem JCC, which is run by an incredible woman named Meg Sullivan, was very open to our partnership with them. And so we started what we call the Hospitality Task Force. And their job is to go out into the communities where we know there are Jewish women who are not participating with us, and create events. So we had, I'm not going to try to pronounce this word. It's the name of a holiday, an Ethiopian holiday. It's like an Ethiopian New Year. And we sponsored out in Brooklyn a whole day event for families and kids. And we weren't necessarily trying to get members, quote unquote members. What we were trying to do was be in the community with people without an agenda. Right. One of the barriers to the Jewish community is also that we are not transparent, right, as a whole. We say, come on this trip to Israel and it's free, but what we're hoping you'll do is meet a nice Jewish boy or girl and marry them.
Right.
Right. And my son went on Birthright, loved it. Nothing against Birthright. What I'm against is the lack of transparency about what these things are about. So come to our leadership program. You don't have to pay anything. It's a great program. And in the back offices, what we're talking about is how are we going to get those 10 people who came to our leadership program to make a donation or right. be a member or whatever, right? So what we're trying to do is be transparent. We want you to participate with us, and we're going out into the community to support your events. And they are not connected. If we meet us and you're interested, great, come on. And if you're not, that's fine too, because the whole point was the event. Now, we have met women now in the Ethiopian community who come to our events, who are interested in what we're doing, and that's wonderful. It was an offshoot of relationship. It wasn't an offshoot of, we supported their program, so they want to come to our program. It was that we went there and we built relationships with people. That is a strategy that is unusual in Jewish life. So
Which I think is weird, that really helped us. Of all the places that would be open to collaboration and mutually beneficial relationships and the values we teach ourselves, and that wouldn't be as hard as it actually is.
Right. Well, when I was approached to do a town hall around the gender harassment and abuse that we were experiencing in Jewish life, which was right after the Weinstein story broke. A year before the Weinstein story broke, we had started working with two other foundations to figure out if what we were hearing in the secular world was also happening in the Jewish communal world. And what we found was, yes, we're no better and we're no worse, but it's happening here too. There's a lot of harassment, especially between older men and younger women fundraisers. That's like the, you know, a big thing. But in general, there was a lot of harassment. There was a lot of sexual innuendo, which our work started. I was not in at the beginning. It started because Naomi Eisenberger at the Good People Fund had a grantee who came to her and said, I was just offered, you know, basically $1 million to sleep with a donor. And I don't know what to do. Young woman freaked out. And Naomi started the wheels running. She's turning. She was like, she reached out to a couple of organizations and said, do you know about this? Is this happening? Is anyone doing anything about it? She and Martin Kaminer, who was a friend of hers, they together put out a survey, and we became aware of the survey. One of my colleagues here, Stephanie Blumenkrantz, found this notice about the survey and said to me, do you know this person, Martin Kaminer? Do you know about the survey? And I said, I knew who Martin was. I'd met Martin a few times, but I know nothing about the survey, so go find out. And that started us in this world of providing training for organizations around gender abuse and harassment issues. That happened I always get my years a little murked up here, but we had started that. So the Weinstein story broke in 2017 2016, like in September. The summer before that, in June before that, September, we had started doing these trainings, just kind of like, were people interested in this? How could we do it? We were dipping our toes in the water. And then when the Weinstein story broke, it kind of like broke throughout all communities. It was suggested to me that the Jewish Women's Foundation of New York could do a town hall. And there had been town halls in England, in London, in the theater community. And then the public theater was also doing one here, which was basically, they were very different. One was a 2-day event. One was 2 hours. One, they shared lots of personal stories. And the other, they shared policies and procedures. Great. All good. All good. And I thought, I can't do that. Like, I'm just little Jewish Women's Foundation of New York. I've been here, you know, a year and a half. Like, I don't know what to do. And so I put it on a calendar and I started telling people we were going to do it. And my idea was, I had such hubris. My idea was that we would come up with a list of standards that the Jewish community would follow and everybody would be excited about it because it would be groundbreaking. And I got a call from Lisa Eisner of the Schusterman Foundation, and she said, you know, you don't understand that the Jewish community, if they're not bought in, no matter what great thing you put out, no one's going to buy into it. It's not going to work.
Right.
And I thought, oh man, because I didn't know that, right? I'd never run an organization before. I didn't know any of this stuff. But what I did was I reached out to as many organizations as I knew people at, and I said, do you want to put your name on this thing? And do you want to invite your people to this thing? I didn't even know what the thing was, except that it was on January 25th, and now we were at mid-December. And they basically, almost everybody said yes, and we got 28 other organizations to sign on to the event. So that is an outreach strategy.
Right.
Right. Like that's a grassroots organizing.
On, and you were saying now you have to, right. to get all your people to come and yeah.
Right. You just have to send this information out. That's it. We ended up with 300 people in the room, that's which awesome. Was amazing. And the whole idea was to inform the community that this stuff is happening. Because at that point, now it seems so long ago and trite, but at that point, people were like, that doesn't happen in the Jewish community. That's not true. And Jewish communal work, in the Jewish communal workplace, there's not a problem. And what would happen is when when Martin and Naomi put out their survey, they had asked people to tell their stories anonymously. And so we had all of these stories that we had collected. And the first thing we did at our town hall was we had created a script out of those stories. And we had 8 readers read one after another, like snippets of stories that people had told that actually happened in their community across the country and in Israel. And it was shocking, but that was the point, right? Wake up, people, this thing is happening here. And after that, the Safety Respect Equity Coalition was put together. I'm sure it was in the works at the same time. And now we have a movement in the Jewish community to address these issues.
Right.
I'm not saying we started it at all. I'm saying that we were in the right place at the right time.
You've been smart enough to figure out how to work in what was happening outside of your walls to the work that's happening inside
right.
your walls. So you've had a very interesting 3 years, it sounds like, in terms of just the things that you kind of have come up with and run with. And I have 2 questions in regards to that. So the first is just about change management in terms of, you know, how that has been in sort of all these ideas that you have. I know you have stakeholders and, you know, employees and people who have opinions about this, I'm sure. And not that it's a very old organization, but, you know, 20 years is significant. The other question is my more standard question of, you know, whenever I get overwhelmed at work, I always say to my husband, I'm like, I do it to myself, right? So it sounds like you're doing it to yourself in terms of, you know, a great project you think of and you're just going to run with it. It might make you a little crazy and you might be scrambling, you know, 2 weeks before the event to find partners. So just a little bit about how you keep all that balance between, you know, the budget line items and, you know, doing a whole new town hall and your own personal life and your son and your family. So we can start with a bit of how the change management has gone and then give us a little insight as to sort of how you lead your own life and keeping everything balanced and together.
I believe that I drove my staff crazy. So there are 4 of us all together. And we act like there are 40 of us, or I should say, I act like there are 40 of us. I have a fairly high capacity for work, plus I don't have a child at home. My child is 25 and he lives on the West Coast. So I have a little bit more flexibility than my colleagues who at that time had infants, right? It's different. Like, not that we're not all working hard, but it's just different, right? So the public face of what we were doing was only one part of what we were interested in. When I looked at our grant making and I talked to all the people who were involved in our grant making, what kept coming up, I would say to someone, Michelle, what's your favorite grant that we've made? And to a person, I would hear, there's this woman and she created this thing called Yeshiva Maharat, where Orthodox women are being ordained as rabbis. It's groundbreaking. Or there's this woman who is using Israeli technology to build wells in Africa so girls and women don't have to carry water, you know, 10 miles back and forth to the river every day, and they can go to school and they can have businesses. Almost every single thing was about, there's this woman. And then I looked at our grant making and I saw that overall 86% of our grant making had been to programs that were run by women, if not their organizations. And in the last 6 years, 94% were to those kinds of organizations. So why would I give the, you know, let's make something up, the Jewish Institute for Life's organization $80,000 for a woman to be hired to find out what kind of STEM program is needed for girls in the Orthodox community, right? Right. Why wouldn't I just say to the woman who's creating that program, here's $80,000. Right. What do you want to do with it?
Yeah.
Right. I started thinking about this, and one day, literally, I woke up and I said, we should be the National Center for Jewish Women Social Entrepreneurs. It came to me based on some work we had done here in the developing world, and I started floating it to my people, first to the executive committee, then to some of our founders, then to some of our other stakeholders. I learned a lot about adaptive leadership, how to bring people along at a rate that they can withstand loss, and really just worked to incorporate all the great stuff we did around our grant making, women sitting around tables, doing research, finding other great women, into this new strategy where we created this collective of every year we choose 10 women who are Jewish women themselves, using their Jewish values, however they describe them, we don't judge them and their Jewishness, to solve an intractable problem facing women and girls, but using a gender lens, which means not necessarily serving women and girls, but going through it, doing their work through a gender lens. They could be inside the Jewish community, they could be outside the Jewish community, they could be in the United States, they could be outside the United States. And so my board trusted me after lots of focus groups and research projects to guide them into this new way of grant making, which aligned our interest in women and girls with our grant making, with our interest in advocating for issues that affect women and girls. And that's what we do now. So there are no applications. We don't do any of that. We just find really great women and say to them, what would you do if you were part of this collective, basically?
So basically, and you just have really good ideas that nobody can say no to.
Well, that's
a good change in management.
No.
It's all okay. Right. Whatever works.
Well, right. So they could say no. And a lot of the stuff that I want to do isn't done because we don't have the money for it, or we don't have the political will for it, or whatever. But enough of what I'm saying so far is making sense. I'm also the shiny new toy, right? I'm only 3.5 years old here, which I'm starting to crest into no longer being the shiny new toy. But I got a lot of change in the first 3 years, and that was successful. And that's helping my board and my stakeholders say, we can trust Jamie to move us in this direction. With a lot of oversight.
There's a lot of building blocks that you're like initially just like, oh, this, oh, that, oh, let's take care of this, right? That I think the more strategic work that you've done in your previous organizations, right, comes along with getting some of those other important building blocks in place, because you can't jump to, you know, let's do a whole strategic plan when you see so many things that need to be sort of updated before you can move things to the next level like that. So that's awesome.
Right. And it's about relationship, like I said at the beginning, right? It's about my relationship with my executive committee, with my colleagues here, with all the other organizations, with the board, with our grantee partners. Like, that's what's important. And when I put that in front of everything, that strategy for me works. It's all about relationship. It's all about having good relationships. And when I don't have a good relationship with someone, I fix it. That's my strategy.
Nice for our Jewish professionals out there in the field. this is very important. So how do you keep it all together? I assume, I always ask my guests this, so I always assume that they keep it together somehow, or they wouldn't be able to accomplish the work that you've been able to accomplish. So how do you make it all happen?
Right. Well, if you ask me, the answer is going to be different than maybe if you ask my husband or my family.
Always.
But I'm going to tell you what I think. First, I make a commitment to be home no later than 7:30, and most of the time 7 o'clock every single night. And that helps my husband not say things like, don't executive direct me. because well, I can bring my work home.
I haven't got that. I mean, don't CEO me, right?
That's right.
I'm not CEO, yet, but I'm sure I will.
Right. I'm not executive directing you. I'm CEOing you.
Right.
But it's because it was, if I am working all the time, I bring that also that part of me home, which is not good for our relationship. And if I set boundaries around when I work, it's easier for me to stop one thing and do another. So that's one way I keep it all together, is that I keep it separate. That doesn't mean I don't answer emails sometimes at home or on Saturday have to do like a project. I do. Like I do work at home, but I make sure that my relationship with my family and with my husband, my kids, my stepkids, their kids, like that we have good relationships. And then I also do that for my staff. Like that's really important to me, to be a model for them. And when I did a review of my assistant and she said, I always ask, you know, what should we do different? And she said, well, I wish we all would go home on time, including you. And I thought, okay, that's interesting and important for me to hear.
What the modeling is that you're putting out there. Well, for you, right. Some of the lockdowns just fine. No worries for yours.
Right. And then, you know, no emails on Sunday night. I used to write emails to them on Sunday night, right. Not thinking what it must feel like for them to walk in the door on Monday morning, right? So how I keep it together is I have a lot of colleagues in my who are CEOs of other organizations or executive directors who are always willing to take a call. I'm always willing to take call from them. I just started exercising. I think that could have helped at the beginning, but I was very resistant. Yeah. Well, I was very resistant to exercising because I don't really like it, but we did a really big event, a really important event in September. And in August, the stress was hitting me. We were a staff person down. And somebody said, maybe you should exercise. Not that people haven't said that to me my whole life.
Yeah, right.
But I did. I started swimming and it was great. And I think it really has helped me. I couldn't tell you exactly. It's only been like 5 months, if that. But I do see that if not that, something, like do something, exactly. Read more, take time, whatever it is, travel, whatever your thing is, just make sure it's in your life, because at the end, when they kick me out for whatever reason, they're going to kick me out.
25 years from now.
I don't want to say, oh, I didn't have a life during that time.
Right. Right.
Right. This is important.
It's hard, right? Because you get into your work, you're passionate about it, and then it's hard to look at the clock and say, it's 3:30. I really want to go to that 4:15 yoga class. That means I have to drop everything now and walk out the door. And that dropping everything now in these positions is difficult.
It's really hard. And I, you know, I figured out that for me, if I go straight to the gym in the morning before I go to work, there's more chance that I'll actually exercise than if I had a noon yoga class, which I did sign up for also, and I rarely make it.
So,
it's kind of like knowing yourself, knowing your routines, and just not trying to be, I don't try to be someone else. Like I don't go to the gym every day and I don't run on the treadmill, right? Like I don't do those things. I do what's right for me and what I can handle. Maybe at some point I'll do more. I don't know. That's not my goal. My goal is to have a life and have a full, healthy life. And that means self-care in that way. Like once somebody said to me, oh, you should have self-care. So I said to my husband, what should I do for self-care? What does that mean? You know, I'm thinking manicure. I'll get a manicure.
Right.
And he said, well, you should meditate and you should exercise and you should eat more healthily. So I'm exercising. I'm not doing those other things
yet. I joined a gym and the trainer wanted to meet with me and I meet with him. And he's like, okay, so our goal is 19% body fat. I'm like, that might be your goal. It's not my goal.
Right. Like, exactly.
Which exists in which I'm bad. So,
right.
I'm going to use that. Yeah. Yeah, you got to figure out what works for you. And then, you know, forgive yourself, right? If you don't make it to swim one day, you know, saying, all right, it's a new day.
There's another day.
Yeah.
Right. Awesome. Right. Yeah. And I guess I think that if someone were asking me for advice, which you're not, but I'm going to give advice anyway, is to be bold, right? I've always been bold in my career choices, right? I was bold to say to my executive director after 6 months, we need to change my title. Like, I don't see myself as an aggressive person in any way, but I feel like I see women who say, oh, I can't do that volunteer thing because I have to work until 5:30 every day and sometimes even later. And I say, well, what would happen if you said to your boss, I work at the shelter every Tuesday night and I have to be there at 7. Could we partner together to make sure that I'm out of here by 6:30 every Tuesday night? You could say that, but people don't say that. And instead, they give themselves to their work, which is important. And then they don't have the other things that make for, in my opinion, make for a full life. And so when someone, usually a young woman, says to me, I can't, whatever, I say, well, let's talk about how maybe you can. Like, what relationships, what things can you put into place in order to make that thing happen for you? Most parents I know are so overwhelmed with all of it that the feeling of adding something else or the feeling of like rocking any of the boats that they have in the air. Boy, that was a mixed metaphor. You know, messing up any of the balls that they have in the air. I think that is really what most parents are thinking about. Like, how do I keep it, at least in Manhattan, like, how do I keep it all together, right? I was involved in the PTA and I was involved in, you know, I went on the field trips and I got called to school every time my kid had a thing. And I still try to keep everything going. Sometimes I think I wish I were one of those people who are able to say, you know what, I can't do that, whatever it is. I can't volunteer because my son needs me. For me, that was not a good match. And so I had to make sure that I had a way to do all of the things that I needed to do in life.
Right. I think that's just even an important message in terms of advice for males, females, anyone who manages
anybody.
People, you know, look at your own experience and have that sympathy on, you know, staff members that are going through that, and that, you know, you're in a very different place in your life in terms of that work-life balance, and, you know, other people you work with aren't, you know, they're in a different place, and everyone kind of ebbs and flows between that in terms of, you know, how they work and what they need.
Right. I have this sense of, I got to this position late in my career and I have a lot to do. Like, I'm a little bit crazed about that. And I don't want my colleagues to feel like they've missed out on moving up in their careers if that's what they want, or staying at the same place. Like, I want them to feel like at every stage of their lives, they can have what they need and what they want. And that's, you know, I wish I had like been working in the work that I'm working in 10 years before, but I didn't. I was doing something else. Okay.
Yeah, well, then my self-care advice to you is to be kind to yourself. You clearly have a lot of work to do, and you clearly have done so many wonderful things. And this has just been a really fantastic conversation to kind of hear about how you got into this position, the different things that you've experienced in your career, the work that you're doing now, and how, you know, innovative. I don't even think you're trying, but how innovative that you're being for this organization. And so, two questions for you as we close out. The first just being, like, you know, you interact a lot with, you know, mostly the New York Jewish community, but as you were saying, you know, you do grants to lots of other places, and in terms of that, you know, what are you seeing in the Jewish community? How are things maybe shifting? This might not be a short answer, but in your perspective as a grantor, you know, how are things looking? Are they looking great, not so great? You know, you're making these changes to be relevant, right? Are other people making these changes to be relevant? Or have you shifted your focus to granting only to women because that's where you see, you know, the work in the Jewish community really start to move in a progressive direction? And the last one is just anything else that we've covered that you wanted to come back to or add a few remarks to. So I'll let you close us out with some of your bigger thinking, communal perspective for us.
The work that we're doing here to support Jewish women is all about supporting the women leaders that we need right now in the world. So whether that's a leader running a school in Uganda or a leader running a diversity, equity, and inclusion program in for Jewish women of color or ending mass incarceration, whatever the thing is that women are doing, they are the leaders of their organizations. They're the CEOs of their organizations. And those women, I say, if a woman has a great idea, like how to end mass incarceration, I bet she has five other ideas that she wants to do.
Right.
And these are the women who are the going to be the leaders in our community. Some of the women, you know, this is the first quote unquote Jewish money that they've ever received. And this is the first time they're looking at Jewish values as they relate to their work. So what I see is that if we want to raise up women leaders, which I absolutely do, inside the Jewish community and outside the Jewish community, then we need to support women leaders. And that's a really simple equation in my mind. In 2007, I think, I started to hear, oh, there's going to be 60% of the leaders of the community are leaving. They're all men. There's going to be this big transition. And then the 2008 crash hit, and those men did not leave. And it created a bottleneck. And I understand why they didn't leave. Some of them couldn't leave. Like they didn't have retirement accounts left or whatever it was. And it created this bottleneck where really great women had nowhere to go. And great leaders, other feminist leaders. I love men leaders who actually are thinking about gender lens in their work and about all of their constituents, not just the ones who have the same chromosome set up as they do. Right. So there was this bottleneck, and it backed up, and a lot of great women left the Jewish community. So now we're back at it, right? In the next 5 to 7 years, all these men are going to be leaving their jobs, and who's going to replace them? So I love that there are all these programs out there like the Gender Equity and Hiring Project that is looking at how hiring is made. The Ta'amot Project, which is a project of ours, it's looking at how organizations are handling creating whole, healthy workplaces that are free of gender harassment and abuse and or can deal with it, right? Like what all of these initiatives that are run by women to and men that are created to make the Jewish communal workplace better, I think is going to attract quality leaders and keep the quality leaders we have now. Because a lot of people left. There's a woman I know who's a representative in Colorado in the House of Representatives, and she left the Jewish community because of harassment issues. That's terrible, right? Like, what are we doing in order to make sure that in the Jewish community, we have the leaders that we need? So Jewish Women's Foundation of New York is doing what we do. Leading Edge is doing what they do, which is really great work, right? Across the board, they do great work. You know, everybody has their little pieces of what they're doing, or some bigger pieces than others. And I feel like there's a really great future for leadership, not just women's leadership, but all leadership. And that there are openings in the community. And my hope is that all of these transition teams and search committees will start looking inside at some of the women and men who have been stuck where they are because of the bottleneck, and that those people will get the opportunity. And for me personally, this is probably going to be my last job ever, I hope. And I'm out there just trying to raise up other leaders and other help other people see why it's important to have, you know, anti-bias training and why it's important to hire, have women in your leadership cohort, not your, you know, in your C-suite, to have women up there, like why these things are important. And so for me, I'm optimistic about the Jewish communal world. The Jewish community itself, I think we have some real challenges, and I think they're ideological. There's the left, there's the right, there's the center, there's anti-Semitism, there's security issues. There are all these things that are really important. And for my, and my, I guess my theory of change is that we're going to do our part and all the other people are going to do their part. And hopefully at the end of us all doing our part, things will move in a more positive direction, and that we'll feel safer, and more people will be involved with us, and we will have, we will create, you know, we'll be a light unto nations. We will be the leaders that show other people how to live full, complete lives.
Yeah, we are definitely living in some, I'm not going to say interesting, but somewhat scary, you know, and a time. We're living in a time.
Yeah.
That will be.
We are in a time.
Yeah. So, but I love to hear that, you know, you have hope for the Jewish community, and then we'll work out our own issues in terms of how we move forward. And, you know, may every organization be as blessed to have their own Jamie Allen Black to be and make changes where needs are needed. And, you know, there's, you know, people say change is slow, change takes time. I don't think it has to. And I think that the slower change takes, the more the organization or entity needs new vision. And whether that person comes with, you know, 100 years experience or 10 years experience, you know, the right person is there, and being cognizant of finding them and nurturing them. And, you know, some person saw your presentation and was like, that woman, I want that woman to lead us. And hey, you're going to apply to this and you're going to get it and you're going to help us be awesome.
Right.
I think more people having that outlook when they meet people and talk to people and are in those situations of leadership replacement, seeing things that maybe other people might overlook in terms of the leadership qualities of the people we interact with. And then being, you know, once you bring them into the fold, being open to their ideas and what they bring to the table, and realizing that being stagnant is just not going to work anymore.
Well, thank you so much. This is really interesting, and I appreciate your questions. I find them insightful, and I love having the opportunity always to look at these issues from all different angles and think about them. So thanks.
Awesome. Maybe you'll have another middle of the night wake up, you know, miraculous idea that you just have to go with. I'm sure you'll have lots of them, but thank you so much for being on the program, Jamie. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Like this episode? Have a comment or a great suggestion for our next interview? Contact us through our website at itswhoyouknowthepodcast.com or on the It's Who You Know Facebook page. As always, subscribe, rate, and review this podcast so that others can find us. It's Who You Know, the podcast.